Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sam Evans Brown, in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. This hour, that quintessential New England tradition, tapping sugar maple trees and making maple syrup, how the maple industry is evolving and adapting to climate change and a changing market. But first, over the weekend, two more people in New Hampshire tested positive for COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. That brings the total number of cases in the state to four, and Jason Moon, NHPR's health reporter, is here to bring us up to date and to provide some context. Jason, thanks for being on the show.
Good morning, Sam.
So what do we know about these two new cases?
One of them is an adult male in Grafton County. That makes the third case in Grafton County. The other new case is an adult male in Rockingham County out on the seacoast. With the new Grafton County case, this person came into close contact with one of the earlier identified Grafton County cases. So state health officials say they have a clear chain of transmission, as they term it, from the first person identified in Grafton County who came into contact with the second person then came into contact with the third person. The Rockingham County case is related to travel. That person recently returned from Italy. And as far as health officials know at this moment, that person was self-isolating at home in the days before they were diagnosed. So they believe that the risk to the community for community spread in Rockingham County is low at this point.
So then in that tells me a story that's fairly clear that this isn't something that seems like is beyond the control of health officials. It seems like we know how it's spreading here in New Hampshire.
Yes, and that's the message from state public health officials, that the outbreaks or the cases that we have in New Hampshire are travel related. So the Grafton County chain of transmission began with travel. The Rockingham County case began with travel. What we're not seeing at this point is widespread community transmission, where, you know, maybe if we had a new case tomorrow and we couldn't readily link that case to travel from abroad, that would be a sign that we have widespread community transmission going on. I think right now state public health officials feel like they have it all in front of them. They can see where the cases that they have came from and can draw a straight line to foreign travel. And so, you know, because of that, they're not issuing any this news just came out over the weekend, and the state hasn't issued any new advisories in terms of travel around the state or going to events or anything like that. You know, the recommendations still are use those same measures you would to avoid getting the flu. Wash your hands, you know, some social distancing when you can, but they're not, for instance, you know, recommending cancellation of events or cancellations of schools, nothing like that at this point.
So what about testing here in New Hampshire? There's been a lot of coverage of the quantity of tests available. We've heard concerns nationwide. What about here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so I talked with state public health officials on Sunday, and what we were told was that the state has the capacity to test about 150 more people at this point. Those are based on test kits they get from the CDC. It is unclear when more test kits might be arriving from the CDC. Meanwhile, commercial testing companies are looking to create their own test kits, including Dartmouth Hitchcock is working on their own version. Though the timeline for those, I'm told, is somewhere in the neighborhood of weeks to being available, say, at your local general practitioner's office. So I don't think that they're anticipating running out of tests in New Hampshire, but I think at some point, we will reach a point where more of the testing is done on the commercial side through these commercial tests than through the state. But right now, the state is doing all the tests in New Hampshire.
And when you say the next couple of weeks, do we have a – we don't have a firm timeline then? We just have a rough idea of when those companies and might be able to have a test available?
Yes, that's the best I've been able to get so far. We've heard kind of, you know, different projections from different companies, different labs, commercial private labs that are working on these tests. You know, one of the issues is you know, that quality control process and making sure that those tests are as accurate as, you know, what we're getting from the CDC. Because obviously the last thing you'd want is to start getting COVID-19 tests that aren't reliable out on the market. So I think there's a lot of concern about that and keeping trust in these in these tests.
I have to say, though, it is a little bit remarkable that that a test could be just manufactured and made available in such a short amount of time by just a, you know, a local hospital here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, from what I understand of the testing process, it's really not that different from how we test for things like influenza. It's a matter of you know, magnifying the culture, you know, culturing the virus, magnifying it, you know, putting it in an assay and getting a result. So it's kind of the same sort of test that we take for granted in healthcare. It's just it's a new virus, and we need to make sure that the tests we have are sensitive enough to this new particular virus. And then there are other questions about, you know, that the science is still out on in terms of at what point is a test going to become positive? Do you have to wait for someone to have symptoms? Those sorts of questions. So that sort of stuff is still getting ironed out.
So what other types of cancellations have we heard about? Community institutions taking an abundance of precaution on their own.
Right. And again, I should say that this is, you know, these cancellations are not done at the behest of recommendations from public health officials in most cases. This is institutions going sort of above and beyond. So we've heard of, you know, colleges canceling sort of travel abroad programs. Dartmouth College is among those. A Special Olympics of New Hampshire has canceled some events in the state. You know, again, these are not in relation to a broad recommendation from CDC or the state to cancel events. They did say on Sunday that they would be happy to offer advice or guidance on a specific case-by-case basis. So if you're about to host a large event and would like some advice from state public health officials, you can give them a call. Their number is 271-4496. That's the State Bureau of Infectious Disease Control. So that's sort of how they're thinking about it. And then, as you mentioned, some groups around the state are kind of taking that next step and just canceling events in advance of any further issues.
It does seem there's a large amount of concern that perhaps is getting ahead of the public health messaging. I know I coach a ski team, and the ski team was concerned about hosting their awards banquet, thinking that it might be too risky to have that number of people in a room. So that does seem perhaps overly cautious, perhaps.
I think that's a fair assessment. Yeah, we don't have evidence of widespread community transmission in New Hampshire. We don't. There's just not a good reason right now to believe that there are people around us that have COVID-19 in New Hampshire that we haven't yet identified. And, you know, that said, that is one of the issues that you deal with in any sort of epidemic like this, where there's what the virus does to us, and then there's the sort of our reaction to the virus and the all the ripple effects and causes of that, you know, from on high as the stock markets and global markets to what's happening with the local ski team and school.
Town meeting is coming up on next Tuesday. Are we hearing any buzz about towns trying to think about special precautions?
Yes, it varies town by town, but, you know, basic things like supplying disinfectant wipes, supplying, you know, Germex at the locations. I know in Lebanon, they have municipal elections tomorrow. They're going to have a disinfectant wipe for every voter who wants it. And they can wipe down the table in the voting booth and the pen they're going to use to vote with. And so I think officials are, you know, local officials are looking to show folks that it's safe, that you know, these measures are meant to, I think, assure people that it's okay to come out and vote. It'll be safe and clean. On the other hand, it may add to this atmosphere of concern. But that's, you know, it's hard to know exactly if you're out there listening, you know, like, what should my level of concern about this be? You know, the situation right now could change. It could get better. It could get worse.
I think there are some people who I know who go out into the community who would probably be thrilled if there were disinfected wipes every day when they head out into the world. Jason Moon, thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll keep updated. You can read Jason's coverage over at nhpr.org. As we do keep a wary eye on the spread of the coronavirus, perhaps it is more important than ever to continue with traditions that unite us as a community and celebrate our sense of place. March is traditionally Maple Syrup Month, and so we're going to be talking about the sweet stuff for the rest of the hour. Joining us this hour are Dave Anderson, Senior Director of Education for the Society of the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, and himself a backyard sugar maker. Thanks for being on the show, Dave.
Thank you, Sam.
Also, Jen Bartlett-Scarinza, am I getting that right?
Almost. Barton-Scarinza.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Who teaches maple sugaring at the White Mountain Regional High School in Whitefield. Her own maple syrup won Best Maple Syrup earlier this year from the New Hampshire Maple Producers Association. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
And Steve Roberge, acting forest specialist for the UNH Cooperative Extension and maple specialist, who is trained in maple syrup judging and grading. Thanks for being on the show, Steve.
Thank you.
Okay, so if you are yourself tapping trees in your backyard or out in a sugar bush, we want to hear from you this hour. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can get your voice on the radio by calling 1-800-892-6477. You can also tweet us or post on our Facebook exchange, NHPR Exchange, all one word. So, folks, I'd like to start by just going around the room and asking each of you the scale of your operation. How many trees are you tapping? How do you do it? And what's it look like? And, Jen, I'd like to start with you.
Sure. Do we each get an hour? No, I'm just kidding. You're taking a big chance asking sugar makers to talk about their operations because we're generally a very passionate bunch about what we do. My home sugaring operation with my husband is between, when we're all tapped out, 600 and 700 taps. And we boil on a 3x8 evaporator with a few technological advances to help us not be there 24/7, an RO and a steam away.
RO being reverse osmosis?
Yes,
thank
you. Steam
away, I don't know what that means.
Steam away injects air into the boiling sap and just increases the evaporation process. And we boil with wood. John spends all fall cutting nice, fine, dry wood, and then I burn it up in a flash of a few weeks in the spring. And that's on the slopes just above the Northern Presidential Mountains up in Randolph. And then the school sugar bush is a longtime tradition. And we tap just over 300 taps. There's potential for a lot more. And we just recently, within the last 3 years, switched over from a wood-fired evaporator to an oil evaporator, which I wasn't super excited because of the tradition of burning the wood, but with a school schedule, it sure makes it a lot easier. And the students are involved with every step of the process there. So,
and I, with 600 or 700 taps, I assume that you're collecting with tubing?
Yes, we are collecting the tubing on a vacuum system. Drains into one big holding tank that we're checking constantly. As any sugar maker out there knows right now, you're always monitoring your vacuum and making sure your tanks aren't flowing over.
And yet you're here in the studio with
us.
Yeah,
well, my husband is, manning it at home, making sure that we're going to be ready to go. We're boiling tonight to catch up.
And Dave, yours?
Very small. We're 260 taps this year. We've doubled in the first 4 years from like 100 taps to 260. All gravity, no reverse osmosis, no steam away. We covet those things. We envy sugar makers who have, you know, upgraded and made that investment because our motto is we may be slow, but we're inefficient. but yeah, we boil on wood in the backyard. It's a hobby scale. We have a tremendous good time out there, and it's a super fun tradition for our family.
And Steve, yourself?
Yeah, so I'm fully tapped out somewhere between 400 and 500 taps, and then those are two sugar bushes that I have, one right behind my house and one down the road. I like working in the woods as a forester, and so I only sell my sap, and so I don't do any making of my own at my house. But it's kind of a unique process where I'll go and collect the sap, and truck it over to the fellow who will process it. It's a good relationship that we have, and it works out well for us.
And is that a fairly standard role in the maple syrup market? Are there a lot of folks who are just selling sap?
There's not a lot, but there is a lot of sap that's sold or traded or exchanged either at the end of the season when people are just done with boiling and they want to just get rid of some sap. They'll bring it to a larger producer who can handle that, that has a reverse osmosis. But there are folks around, say, like Bascom's, which is a very large producer of maple syrup. Bascom's will buy in sap from other folks or actually just lease a sugar bush next door to them.
I'm also hearing the phrase tapped out used a lot. Is this the origin of the term tapped out? Does anyone know?
I don't know.
It's really great to hear it used in a way that is actually relevant to the term. So just to define a couple terms that we've been throwing around here, reverse osmosis. Who wants to describe what reverse osmosis is? Jen?
Sure. Reverse osmosis, I call it the magic machine because it removes about 75% of the water from the sap before it even touches the pan. Generally, maple sap that comes out of the trees you're hoping for 2 to 3% sugar. Can drop down to 1 at the end of the season, and that's when you start making decisions about is it worth the fuel to boil it. So between 2 and 3%, and then you pass it through the RO, which is essentially a membrane, and the sap is forced under pressure through the membrane. The water molecules are much larger. The sugar molecules are much larger, and the water molecules are smaller, so they're allowed to pass through. So it concentrates it. And then when it hits the pan, it's a much faster process.
There may be some folks who are familiar with reverse osmosis because I know I have it in my basement cleaning my drinking water.
Okay.
Also, vacuum. Steve, maybe describe what vacuum is and how recent of an innovation that is in the maple world.
Yeah. So vacuum is essentially it's used in a tubing system, and you'd actually hook up a vacuum pump to the whole tubing system out in the sugar bush. And the idea is that system is a closed system, so there's no air, in theory, can get into it. And when you hook the vacuum up, it reduces the atmospheric pressure inside the tubing. And that's essentially how sap will flow, is that even without a vacuum system, even on gravity or buckets, the pressure inside the tree is greater than the atmospheric pressure on the outside. And so the sap flows from higher pressure to lower pressure. We have to go back to our science classes to think about that. But we can kind of cheat the system by hooking up a vacuum system to it. And when the conditions are not correct out there in the sugar bush, either because of weather, it's a little too warm or anything like that, we can turn the vacuum pump on and get the sap flowing through that mechanism.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. So I'd just like to compare your operations to the big dogs. So we talked about the taps that you have are on the order of a few hundred. Maybe Dave, I'll throw this to you. How big?
The guy's going to get himself in trouble.
How big do these maple producers get?
They get huge. They get hundreds of thousands of taps, 250,000 taps. I've heard that somebody's soon going to do 1 million taps, but there's outfits in Quebec and in northern New England that are 500,000 taps and more. So that just boggles the mind. I mean, we started with 10 buckets, and it's kind of like a thing that happens. You just start getting bigger and bigger. And so we go to Bascom's every year and buy supplies, and we look at the maple blogs and the trade journals, and you can really geek out on maple. It's a lot of fun at a backyard scale to try to stay at that scale and not get seduced into the latest and greatest. But big, big operations are effectively like maple factories with pipelines leading in and tanker trucks or flatbeds carrying barrels out.
So, Steve, if you were to look at an operation like that and compare it to Dave's Sugar Shack, which, by the way, I have seen. I have visited Dave's Sugar Shack. It's very handsome, but it is made from wood. And it's a shed. How would that compare to some of these bigger operations if you were to visit the hub where the syrup is made?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the very bigger one, the very large ones are pretty much like Dave said, more of a factory type of setting. It's everything's food grade material. They're bottling in more of a manufacturing process, a bottling line that you would see there, just like in any food manufacturing facility. But it's pretty amazing what one can produce in a simple sugar shack in terms of volume. The majority of the producers in New Hampshire are not the large scale folks, not the Bascom's not the 20, 40,000 taps that we see, or even 100,000 taps elsewhere across the Maple region. Most of our 500 to a couple thousand taps in that setting. And so even at that scale, you can produce a large volume of syrup in just the traditional sugar shack with efficiencies of reverse osmosis, a really good pan, and just good techniques of collecting and handling sap.
And I guess if we're thinking about this economically, you can still be economical at that 500 to 1,000 tap scale, or is this folks, are they doing it for the love of it?
Yeah, so let's say the 10 bucket operation, that's just a fun thing to do with the kids.
Totally.
2,000 taps or more, you're probably making a profit somehow. And anything in between that, they say, is just a really expensive hobby.
Yeah.
There's a lot of community involved with sugaring. I feel very lucky that growing up, my parents introduced us to that. And so I count myself as one of the lucky ones that's kind of gotten to sugar my whole life in many different aspects. But when I think about sugaring, yes, I love to be in the woods. I love to make the syrup. There's a lot of pride in the product. But there's that aspect of the friends and family and your community and your neighbors that come to visit. And so that is a big piece. Dave was explaining earlier about, sugaring with his children and his grandchildren and, my family. It's now passing on to my nephews, and it's just a big part of the experience.
Jen, you made it sound like it was just you and your husband, but it sounds like the whole tribe comes together.
Oh, no, it's everybody's involved. Yeah, I come from a line of sugar makers in Loudoun. Yeah.
It's magical. It's a full sensory experience, the sights and sounds and smells, the wood smoke, the crackling fire, just the arch doors opening and closing. I was out in the moonlight Saturday night because it's a full moon tonight, and we were boiling after 12 hours. I was watching the sparks come out of the stack, and we were winding down. It was like 10 o'clock at night. We'd been out there since 10 in the morning. And I could hear the sap dripping in some of the few buckets that we have around the sugar house, just plinking. And I just knew winter was cooked. Winter is over. When you're sugaring, it's spring. It's all good. The temperatures are warming. The bluebirds are showing up. The sap buckets are dripping. And so it's a really joyful kind of a spiritual pursuit. I tell people it's as close to taking communion with trees as you possibly can.
I imagine that when you light up the fire in the evaporator, that people might just sort of materialize to come and take part, perhaps folks you don't even know.
If they have money in there, they're to buy syrup. I'm very happy to have people come by.
Or sometimes they bring you cookies because they know you've been there for long hours, and they're just trying to bring you sustenance to keep you going for the next long push.
I'm curious to know, with all the change, Dave, that you alluded to, and all the the glossy magazines, the degree to which that is trickling down all the way through, and maybe that's what we'll talk about when we come back. Coming back from the break, we're going to talk about how climate change is affecting New Hampshire's sugar maples, and we want to hear from you. Email us exchange@nhpr.org, tweet us, or visit our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word, or give us a call 1-800-892-6477. I'm Sam Evans Brown. This is The Exchange, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today we are talking about the allure, the mythology, and the business of maple syrup. Joining us are Dave Anderson with the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, Jen Scorinza, who teaches at White Mountain Regional High School, and Steve Roberge, a specialist with the UNH Cooperative Extension. Give us a call. We want to know about your maple questions. We want to know about your sugar bush, whatever it is, however you relate to maple syrup. We want to hear about it. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Also, find us on social media. All right, so we've all seen the headlines, Steve. Climate change is coming for your maple syrup. How true is that?
Well, I always start when someone asks me a question about climate change, I always point out I am not a climate scientist.
Nor are any of us.
Yeah, I'm a forester, but I do work in the environment where we may see some of these impacts. And so, with climate change, there's a lot of concerns that we have in terms of The weather that we see during the spring months, but also the weather that we see across the whole year, because that plays a big role on the health and the stresses that are put on maple trees that we see here. So when we think about climate change, there's always discussion about, we're going to get more rain, but there's going to be droughts in between when we have those rains. And so sugar maple is a species that doesn't like droughts. It doesn't perform very well in droughts. And so if it's on sites that are droughty to begin with, that's an additional stress we see on those trees. Climate change predictions as well, looking at less snowpack over time, too. We've seen that with some research at Hubbard Brook, even from the 50s to today, seeing less and less snow out in the woods. Sugar maple roots are pretty sensitive, and so when they don't have that nice blanket of snow to protect them and to be insulated from frost, you get frost penetrating deep into the soil. That can affect sugar maple health just by damaging roots. And so there are a number of stresses and conditions that could be potentially created with climate change that will negatively affect sugar maple health. And it's just one more stress that sugar maple will be seeing over time. And so when you have things that come through that are natural events, such as a forest tent caterpillar outbreak, that's just maybe the final nail in the coffin for a tree or a stand of trees that's like that. So we don't know. That's the big thing, right? So when I see a headline like that, it's a little bit of an eye roll just because it's like, oh, this person's figured it out,
Yeah.
But that's definitely a concern. And the other part of this, though, is sugaring is all about weather. And weather and climate are two different things, right? Weather's happening right now. And so we may still have the weather decades out, but the weather may be coming at a different time of year, maybe coming a lot sooner. But we may still collect the same amount of sap during those weather events that are appropriate for sap flow.
One of the innovations that I've heard about in recent years has been that there's a new type of tap that makes it so that you can tap earlier in the year without risk of the tree, growing back over and sealing that tap hole up. Am I getting this right?
Yeah. So Dave's holding one right now. It's a check valve spout. And so the idea is that this little ball that will get sucked back in as the tree starts to freeze up again at night. And so without that ball present, that valve present, sap would be sucked back into the tree. And that sap will have bacteria, mostly bacteria, that over time during the season, that bacteria growth builds and builds and builds and actually plugs up the wood vessels. And that's the first step of the tree healing after being tapped, is that the tree doesn't heal over right away. It may take a year or two for that to happen. But it's really those wood vessels that get plugged up with bacteria, and that slows the sap flow out of there. And so those check valve taps have come on the market, and people use those to prevent that quote-unquote contamination of that natural bacteria into the tap hole.
Which then means that they can tap the trees earlier in the year and catch some of those midwinter runs. Is that right?
In theory, that's the case. Yeah,
in theory.
Yeah. There's a lot of research. UVM, the Proctor Maple Research Center, does an amazing amount of research here in the United States on tapping. They've investigated that, tapping even as early as November and going all the way into April and seeing the impacts of that.
Dave, you said Jen, you have a thought?
Yes, looking at the graphs from Proctor is fascinating with the students. When you look at the drop-off and the sap yield from not replacing your taps every year so that there's new plastic in the tree, and then eventually replacing your drop lines, which is the part that goes from the tree down to the main lines, it's just interesting to see, because you think, oh, we're just spending a lot of money on new equipment and replacement taps. But when you actually look at what the research has been done, it's fascinating to see the difference in the yield of sap.
One of the numbers that I had here in front of me is actually from the Proctor Research Maple Research Lab, which is that when we talk about the difference between climate and weather, obviously weather is one thing, and the sugar season can vary quite a lot from year to year. But on average, over the past 50 years, we've lost about 3 days of sugaring weather, is what the Proctor Research Lab had put out. Does that jive with you all's observations out there in the woods?
It's different every year. It depends on the weather, and everybody always asks, so how's the season going? And the answer is always, ask me in April
or
May.
Yeah, or I always say to people, I'm way too young to give a prediction like that.
But I mean, so we jumped on the let's tap in January and see if it's worth it. And this year we were collecting sap in January. We did our first boil on February 1st. We did our second boil on February 6th, and then nothing until February 26th, in which case I said, probably wasn't worth it to go 20 days with nothing happening while the trees were essentially healing up and closing. The check valve taps enabled us to sort of do that, as opposed to the old steel taps with the bucket that we used to use where it's airflow. And we're just gravity, so it comes out of the trees when it's running and it doesn't when it's not. So we're all about the weather. we can't use a vacuum to pull any sap at our operation because it's small.
Yeah, and some of the bigger producers will tap out, in January just because they have to. They have so many taps, they have to go out in the woods with their crews and just start tapping regardless of the weather. So when you see those larger producers going out, it may not be because they think it's the right time to tap. It's just that they have to get it done. I know for myself, I tapped when I tapped because that was the weekend I had time to do it.
Right.
And so that's how it worked for me.
And in a school setting, it fits usually pretty nicely between February vacation and April vacation. We do some work ahead of time when we get the new semester of students. But as far as being tapped and ready to boil, that's generally the season. It's a pretty intense time, as any sugar maker knows. And you're trying to capitalize every bit that you can. And those big producers, they can't afford to miss that first run.
Hmm. And it used to always be town meeting day. I mean, that's what the old timers told me when I was growing up. And now it's pretty clearly Valentine's Day or President's Day. I think Martin Luther King Day was a little early for us, but we tried it to see what was going to happen.
As in town meeting day was when you should tap your trees.
Tap your trees. But last year, our first boil was on St. Patrick's Day. We were like 2.5 weeks late last year. And this year, our first boil was February. And that was just the weather thing.
Yeah. So weather aside, obviously, it's getting warmer. Sugar season's coming earlier. Can we circle back and talk about the forest health piece of this? Because it seems to me that we have lost sugaring days, but we've also had this incredible flush of technology that seems to have greatly offset that the loss in sugaring days in terms of actual maple production. But long term, the maple trees themselves seem like they're in a tough spot. Is that right, Steve?
Yeah, well, maple trees, well, a lot, let me back up. A lot of sugar bushes that we have across the state, across essentially the maple region, have been cultivated decades ago to be just that, to be a sugar bush. And so a lot of times there may be sugar maple growing what we call off-site. And so the idea that, every tree has a specific requirement and they're all different. And so a white pine grows in certain soils and a sugar maple grows on different soils. And we may see that there are sugar maples growing on soils where it's not ideal for them. And so that's where we see the issue of changing climate, all these weather factors that may come into play where those trees may be kind of fizzling out or dying off just because they're off-site. If we were to walk away for 200, 500 years, those trees wouldn't be there regardless of what's going on.
Right. They're there because we put them there.
Exactly. And so sugar maple that are on site are very resilient. And we see sugar maple sites, stretching from Quebec all the way down to, say, North Carolina and further west. And so those are trees that are on site where they're supposed to be. And they do quite well, where they're growing. And they can weather the storm of, different different stresses that may be thrown
at them. And sugar maple is like a rich, moist site. So it's not across the forest. They are pretty resilient, but you'll see them along roadsides. They're dying back because of root compaction or road salt. And so they don't really take a lot of the pollution and population stressors of being paved over and confined. But, they're kind of fussy that way. They're also very resilient in terms of being able to recover from wounds, which is a good thing if you're a sugar maker because people are poking holes in you. So, and in one case, it's kind of a fussy tree, but on the other hand, it's pretty strong and resilient. It's a beautiful tree. It's a long-lived tree. I would argue it's the finest tree in the New Hampshire forest because it brings people here in the fall and it brings people here in the late winter. And when people are thinking about forests, it's all good.
Yeah. So you mentioned that its ability to heal. Steve, the listeners can't hear it, but Steve has what we call a tree cookie, a sort of cross section of a tree trunk that has all sorts of tap holes that you can see where it's healed over, which I think brings us to a common question, which is, does sugaring and tapping a tree hurt the tree? Does anyone want to take that?
Sure. It does damage the tree at the site of the tap hole and about probably 6 inches above and below and the width of the tap hole. But as Dave mentioned, the tree recovers from that. It's kind of like healing up a wound on yourself. The tree adds a fresh layer. It closes up. A healthy tree will close up between 1 and 3 years later. You can still see the hole, but it's completely closed in. And then it just continues to add fresh layers of new growth over that scar. It's amazing when you see a giant tree cookie, almost as big as this table, where you can see successive generations of tapping, the tap wound from your grandfather and then your father and then the current generation, from that tree. It's really fun to look at the scars on the tree. But to do responsible tapping, you wait until the trees are big enough. You don't rush it. And that's a fun thing to teach the students because it's about that management decision with your own forest. And if you're leasing trees, there's probably going to be guidelines about that. But if you have your own forest, you make the choices about how many taps you put in a tree. When I was a kid, and I'm sure you guys remember, if you couldn't put your arms around it, you put four or five buckets on it. And that's not the standard anymore, yeah. You know.
And you know, obviously, as you are taking sap from the tree, that's carrying sugars that were stored in the roots of the tree for the use of the tree. Are we just skimming off the surplus, or to what extent is the amount that we're taking meaningful to the health of the tree?
I always characterize trees as very redundant creatures. They have way too many roots for themselves, way too many branches, way too many leaves, and a lot of starch, a lot of sugar that's stored in them. And so, yeah, a healthy tree can totally handle what you're extracting from a sugaring operation. So if, you know, high efficiency operation, you may be taking out 20, 30 gallons of sap out of that tree over the season. Trees move an amazing volume of water throughout the whole year. So it's just, I don't want to say it's a drop in a bucket, but it's definitely something they can handle.
And is that true even once we apply vacuum, which of course increases the amount of sap yield per tree?
Yeah, I would say it's the same. And, you know, a lot of researchers have looked at the growth of the tree on vacuum and not on vacuum. And there's really no difference in that.
Hmm. So Katie asks, and we have an email here from a listener. I have 300 sugar maples on my farm in Durham that syrup by the sea, a sugar shack in Portsmouth, identified for tapping, but they've never had time to do it. I don't have any ability to do it myself. Do you have any ideas on how you might find someone interested in tapping these trees for you? Is that a part of this industry where folks will just, do your sugar bush without sort of on a, I don't know, what basis, a lease?
Yeah, there are maple tap leases on Forest Society property and on private property. It's just a function of, are there people nearby who are in the industry who are looking to expand? And I think that there are sugar makers who are on the upswing and there's sugar makers who are on the downswing. Between my little town of South Sutton and Bradford, I can point five different sugar houses that are shuttered. Hmm. And I remember going in there in years past. And that's kind of at the hobby scale. But then there's regional producers. It's like ski areas, get big or get out. A lot of New Hampshire folks have gone to become kind of regional powerhouses and gotten bigger at the expense of the small mom and pop operations.
I would point out the New Hampshire Maple Producers Association is a great resource to kind of tap into if that individual wants to contact them to find a local sugar maker.
I think my general overarching question about the maple syrup industry is actually one that Dave, you just alluded to, and I'll just sort of throw it out here. When you say that get big or get out, and that's happening at the expense of little producers, is that true that larger producers are actually pushing smaller producers out of the market?
I think there's always new people who are getting in too, so it's not like, you know, there's a big maple consortium, maple mafia. I know that came up in this. The sap heist story that you did in the past.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Okay, so it seems to me that we're probably likely to have syrup in the years going forward, all things willing. I guess my general question here that I was alluding to just now is what do we lose if we're losing small producers? What is the sort of cultural loss that we see in New Hampshire as we move away from shacks like Dave's towards more sort of the high production food grade safe rooms model? Do you want to take that chance?
Sure. I think we would lose a lot of the history and the traditions, but we're also losing a valuable connection, to the kids and the next generation that would be interested. As a teacher of maple sugaring, some people have said, oh, isn't that quaint? Well, no, it is quaint and it is fun to learn the traditional ways, but it's about the technology and the science and the math that's involved with the teaching the industry. And if we were to lose the small sugar makers, then you're also losing that local food source that many people are moving back to more and more. Maple syrup is extremely healthful sugar sweetener as a substitute, and lots of people are using it exclusively. And they like to know what trees their syrup comes from. I love the fact that our neighbors can look at the hillside and say, all of our syrup came from this place. And so I think we would lose that. The other beautiful thing about maple sugaring, and it's been alluded to here already, is that no matter the scale, it's the same magical process. And you can do this with your kids with five taps and, you know, some food grade plastic and boil it in a pot in the front yard. And as a family activity, one of the biggest satisfying things for me is when some of my former students will come back and tell me about making syrup with their children. And you see them buying, you know, bits of equipment and things like that. Or students that borrow a couple of buckets and take them home and tap some trees, and their parents want to know, what have you showed my kid? Now we're spending a lot of money on propane to get a couple of gallons of syrup. But the process and the learning and the experience is so much more.
Yeah, I'll point out too, you know, what else, you know, what do we lose if we lose the small producers? And that comes to any time we're doing anything in the woods, we lose that connection, whether it's the person who is working in the woods or the people who are coming to buy syrup, buy firewood, view birds, anything like that. When we lose something like that in our state, which is, you know, vastly forested, we lose that connection to the forest, and we probably end up losing the forest over time.
On that same front, is there something we gain, though, as well? Because I remember a maple producer from, I believe it was SUNY, I'm going to get this wrong, but up in New York State, told me that only, you know, something on the order of 2% of maple trees in New England are actually tapped. And so as the scale expands, that's more trees that are providing, you know, value to landowners.
It's a valuable multiple use process. For example, the Randolph Town Forest leases about 25,000 taps to a big sugar maker, Dave Fuller, in our area. And if you calculate it out, the value to the town forest in tapping those trees for multiple years and the leasing fees is much more than cutting those trees once as timber. It also leaves the trees there, as Steve said, for people to enjoy.
And walk in between.
Yes,
absolutely. And of course, provide all those other ecosystem services that we rely on, of course, for.
You know, jobs for the economy.
Right. Coming up, we will talk about how changes in the maple industry are impacting our forests and our breakfast tables. This is The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and we will be right back.
From the seacoast to the Upper Valley, Monadnock to the Great North Woods, NHPR covers the stories that impact your community to help you stay connected to what's happening in every corner of the state. I'm Annie Ropeek, a reporter here at NHPR, and when you give $10 a month as a sustainer, you'll help support a vital resource that is statewide, regional, and deeply New Hampshire. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, we are talking maple syrup. Here in the studio, we have Dave Anderson, Senior Director of Education for the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, a backyard sugar maker himself, Jen Scorinza, who teaches maple sugaring at White Mountain Regional High School in Whitefield, also a maple sugar maker whose syrup won Best Maple Syrup earlier this year from the New Hampshire Maple Producers Association, and Steve Roberge, Acting Forest Specialist for the UNH Cooperative Extension and Maple Specialist. Give us a call. We want to know what you want to know about maple syrup and forest health. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or find us on social media. Steve, I want to start out by talking about perhaps the elephant in the room, Quebec, who, when you look at the numbers, the amount of syrup that Quebec produces compared to the rest of the world is truly staggering. They produce most of it. In fact, they have this huge outsized impact on the rest of us because they sort of dictate the market. So can we talk a bit about what's going on up in Quebec and how their system is different than ours?
Sure. Yeah. So Quebec, yeah, is by far the largest producer worldwide of maple syrup. Probably 72% of the syrup produced comes from Quebec. And it's a huge industry. I think it's a little under $1 billion in terms of what they make off of that. And so it's important to Quebec. And so therefore they have developed a group and also have a strategic reserve of maple syrup, which is just an amazing thing.
Which famously had some stolen from it.
Yeah, a number of years ago. It's a fabulous story. And you know that reserve is probably about 8 million gallons of syrup, or you know over that coming into the 2020 season, which means if we could have 2 years in the United States where we don't make syrup, and that could fill the void. It's pretty impressive, and so that has impacts on the price of syrup. And so essentially, what that reserve has done, and the quota system that is in Quebec, has created stability within the markets. So instead of having these huge swings in the price of syrup. Syrup worldwide is sold by the pound, and right now it's probably around the low $2 range, $2.20 a pound, something like that. But you know, instead of swinging up to $3 and down to $1.50, it kind of maintains. There is variation within the price, but depending upon the season. But that strategic reserve has essentially set the baseline or the bottom of the price of syrup, and that allows for folks in Quebec, but also across the maple region here in New Hampshire, Vermont, to be able to have a predictable price of what they can invest in. So they know their bottom line with that too. So there's some pros and cons to it, because when the seasoners would be really good for you and maybe bad for others, you could capitalize on that high price of syrup, which no longer exists anymore. But it also allows you to get into it and invest. And so that helps, you know, some of the bigger producers where they're really looking at long-term costs versus the hobby person.
So then obviously that means that we're benefiting, we're sort of free riding off of this system because Quebec has instituted these price controls.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it that way. The other way, again, is that if Quebec had a crop failure and the United States had a boom year,
right.
we would not see the benefit of that boom year because right. Quebec would just put their reserve onto the market. So it's that's a problem for us.
So when you go out into the community and talk to producers, to what extent is it perceived to be a good time to be getting into maple? To what extent are people sort of bullish on maple right now?
Bullish on maple. Yeah, I think most of the folks who get into it because it's a passion. Like, you know, Dave, you know, kind of described that magical moment, and people just do it for community reasons. They do it for, oh, I did this when I was a kid and I have time now. And so I think it's just a lot of people are just really interested in just developing that hobby. And a lot of times hobbies become a little bit of a side business.
There's a lot of math involved, and you can really geek out on prices or volumes or the pound weight. And it's about 11 pounds per gallon density as opposed to 8 pounds per gallon for water. A gallon of syrup is about 11 pounds. And you can also kind of look at the bricks using a hydrometer and know when to pull it off based on the temperature and the density. There's a whole lot of lessons going on out there. But the one thing that most people forget is the rest of the world don't really use real syrup. I almost said real New Hampshire maple syrup. So the really, most people are eating corn syrup with maple flavoring on their pancakes and waffles, perish the thought. So the thing that unites us more than divides us is to say to the world, this is real syrup. So the best thing you can do is buy real maple, whether it comes from Canada or whether it comes from Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts. And then if you really want to keep your dollars local, buy real New Hampshire maple syrup, and then you're supporting your neighbors who are just doing this.
Well, and one of the things that the Quebec Association does is promote maple around the world. And that's where another way.
I'm a free rider. I'm a free rider.
Well, it's maple month, so get out and visit your local sugar bush.
Yeah.
Get the steam in your face. We've talked a lot about the romanticism of the sugar house. I got engaged in our sugar house. But when you look at the dollars, there's also people outside of the industry, you know, and you guys may know these businesses more than I, but people have invested millions into new operations all across northern New England. So what may on some levels still seem quaint and you know, fun and we enjoy it all, but it's also a lucrative business for many of these large operations, providing potential jobs. You know, my students could go to work for these companies. The other thing, and Dave touched on this about the density, you know, the whole value-added products, lots of people think that perhaps maple sugar candies are made. Well, how much sugar do you add? We don't add sugar. We just take out more water. Mm-hmm. Pure maple products are all made by monkeying with the densities. And that's a whole lesson and many lessons in itself and a lot of fun. And the economies of, if you can sell the syrup for $60 a gallon in a plastic jug, but perhaps you put it in glass bottles or you turn it into cotton candy or maple cream, what is the economic benefit in that and the marketing piece there?
Well, and the fact that you can keep boiling syrup to turn it into, you know, solid products gets to the fact that we call ourselves, or you call yourselves, sugar makers as opposed to syrup makers, right? And right. Am I wrong that in sort of colonial days, that was the dominant form of production, was making sugar, not syrup?
Yeah, because you couldn't carry liquid weight. Yeah, you could carry a cake of sugar in a little saddlebag when you were walking across the hills of New England, but you were carrying a jug of maple syrup.
Right. So Steve, during the break, we talked about this a bit. What is the landscape of producers like? You know, we've talked a bit about the big fish, but they are not the big story, I guess.
Yeah, I think in New Hampshire, we probably have reported 500, 600 producers across the state, and maybe about 5% of those have taps over 5,000. And so what that tells me is that there's a lot of producers that are very small, you know, 500, 1,000, 2,000 taps. 2,000 taps is getting a little big. But, you know, the landscape of New Hampshire's sugaring industry is just those folks, maybe some backyard sugaring, small sugar shacks. So it is still very small and traditional as well. And we do have these larger producers, which is great because they can provide support for the smaller ones, selling equipment, buying sap, and just helping out with research as well.
Jen?
That's a great tie-in to the mentoring aspect of the larger sugar makers. There's a number of programs right now. There's been a lot of more interest from elementary schools, junior high school, in learning about sugaring as a vehicle for so many different lessons. And the New Hampshire Ag in the Classroom program has tremendous lesson plans online. They're supported with the New Hampshire Farm Bureau, and teachers can go online and download the lessons or get a local sugar maker to come in and work with their class. There's a couple of competitions, the Felker Award for individuals, the Tucker Mountain Challenge, where last year 13 schools and over 800 students participated and submitted a sample of syrup to be graded and tasted just like the regular sugar makers, and they can take that prize money and invest it back into their own operations.
I guess when as an educator, I imagine that you see that this is a great hook to get kids interested in the woods.
Absolutely. What could be better? They get to get school credit for being in the woods, which they enjoy, making something that they can eat, marketing something that they're very proud of. One of my favorite days is when the younger children come to visit the high school, and our high school students get to be the rock stars. They present about something that they are knowledgeable about, and they plan out little workshops as the kids rotate around. They'll tap a tree, they show the density, they explain the filter press. It's a wonderful developmental skill for public speaking and presentation skills. Our superintendent comes every time we invite her. It's wonderful to watch them be able to shine about something they really love to do.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. So Jen, can you just lay out for me exactly what the programming is like at White Mountain Regional High School? And also, I'm curious how many kids get into this.
Sure. So maple sugaring has been a part of the high school for, I would say, 30 to 40 years. One of our local supporters, Dave Fuller, was there when it started. He talks about, you know, jumping the fence and going in to boil late evenings and where the ag teacher would hide the tractor key so that they could gather. And then when I started working there about 17 years ago, sugaring was a part of the Natural Resources and Forestry program, which was extra fun but challenging also because it was only one small piece of an overall curriculum. And as we know, when you're sugaring, you're either doing it or you're not doing it. And so that was 6 weeks in the spring where pretty much sugaring dominated the curriculum. And so about 3 years ago, the high school decided that it would stand on its own as mm-hmm. its own elective. Mm-hmm. And so maple sugaring is the title of the class. We have anywhere, some years we have two sections. This year we have one section of 22 students. And we get them in January. We start walking the lines, making sure that we can start working on the damage from the moose and the squirrels and the snow, and then tapping and boiling. We have a sugar house that's right outside back of the high school with the evaporator. And then we do the value-added products inside in a food-grade kitchen, which is another aspect. We are producing a food product to sell. And it's very important that that be the highest quality. And it's fun to teach them about the industry standards. And yes, we need to wear gloves when we package our maple candy. And then how do you present that in the best possible way to the customers?
And are you teaching, you know, vacuum and reverse osmosis? Are you teaching all the modern tools?
Most of the modern tools. Reverse osmosis requires a lot of attention and time that hasn't yet fit into the school schedule. But we do have a vacuum that helps with the pulling out the sap.
Well, great so much. Shockingly, amazingly, we have run out of time here on the show. Thank you all so much for being with me. Our guests, Dave Anderson, Senior Director of Education for the Society of Protection New Hampshire Forests. Thanks for being here, Dave.
Thank you, Sam.
Jen Scarinza, who teaches maple sugaring up at White Mountain Regional High School, as we were just hearing. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you. It was a treat.
And Steve Robert, Acting Forest Specialist for the UNH Cooperative Extension and trained in maple grading and judging. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Sam. That's great.
The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our regular theme music is composed by Bob Lord. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Remember, the conversation continues online and on Facebook and at nhpr.org. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and thanks so much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.